There will be no foolish wand waving or silly incantations in this class.
Catapult of propaganda.
The truth out there.
Some alien race to come down and threaten us. The military's industrial complex.
The PID Radio. I'm Derek Gilbert.
And I'm Sharon Gilbert, everybody, and welcome to our humble bunker. It's June the 1st. Is this the first day of
June? It is the first day of June. It is busted out all over.
You don't want to say that around here. Not Buster, anyway. We used to have a dog. I can't remember if we were on the air when we had Buster or not.
No, Buster predated the show.
Yeah, you know what? He was an experiment. He was a puppy that we found and just fell in love with. Actually, he was a birthday present from me one year. And Murphy hated him.
Buster was the demon dog from...
Heck.
Yes.
Oh, gosh. He hated that little guy. We found a great home for Buster, but...
He was hyperactive.
He was... Oh, you know, he was... what was the
he's a rat terrier.
A rat terrier,
yeah, rat
yes.
terrier.
So you can picture a dog...
High maintenance.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep.
Murphy's pretty laid back most of the time. I mean, he likes to wrestle when I come home in the afternoon, but most of the time Murphy enjoys his, he's by himself time. You know, he's a cool dude, and, you know, doesn't.
In a loose mood.
Yeah, he's pretty low maintenance. But
well, for the most part, he and Java get along really well. She has a very similar temperament, with the exception that he is almost 6.5 years old,
mm-hmm.
and she is just barely five and a half months old.
That's right.
So she has much more energy than he does, but they crash just about the same time, and we'll sleep many, many hours.
That's right.
Before waking. So
and we must say that she's been really good for Murphy. If you've seen the pictures of the two of them together, you see that he's bigger than she is, but she gives him every bit of what he gives her, and it's really been good for him because after, you may remember, we had the two older dogs, mm-hmm. Belle and Gretel, and after they went on to the mm-hmm. that backyard in the sky.
Mm-hmm.
Murphy was really despondent. He'd lost his pack, and he was really losing muscle tone. It got to where he could not jump up onto our bed, which is a little higher than the average bed.
Mm-hmm.
But now with the extra exercise of having the energetic puppy around, he's rounded back into form, and he's...
He has no trouble at all.
No, he leaps like a cat.
He can do a vertical leap of about 5 feet.
Which, that high?
Yeah. I've seen him jump really high. Well, let's say 4 feet, for sure.
4 feet's still pretty amazing. That's anyway.
Yeah. Well, I guess 4 feet. He could jump. He could do a vertical leap onto that.
The bookcase?
Yeah, he could if he wanted to.
That is about a 48-inch bookcase.
Yeah.
Wow. So, anyway, well, that's the state of the dogs here in the bunker. Thank you, everybody. And we've got part two of our great interview with Peter Goodgame. And it's great not because of the interviewer, but because Peter is such a fount of information. The research that he's done into ancient Sumeria, the ancient Near East, you know, like Bethvay, is so extensive. And then how he relates it into end times prophecy.
Mm-hmm.
And when he's going to talk about... over the next day or so, the symbology of the seven-headed dragon, which apparently predates the writing of the Book of Revelation by, 3,000-4,000 years.
You know what kills me about Peter Goodgame and many of the people we've spoken to over the past series, and even during the course of doing this show,
mm-hmm.
There are times that I hear, what is a unique perspective? And I just do the head slap, you know? I have dents in my forehead that you would just be amazed at because of all the head slapping where I go, oh, of course.
Mm-hmm. Why didn't
says,
I see that
yeah,
before?
Yeah, exactly. Well, when you explain it that way, yes, I can see that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that doesn't say that we agree with everybody that comes on our show because that's just not going to happen. That's not human nature.
Mm-hmm.
But you know what? There are a lot of really interesting points of view that we've had a privilege to bring forth on PID Radio.
Absolutely.
Lots of news to bring forth.
Yeah.
There's a duck
Well, I kind of thought you'd want to make that the top story.
Well, I want to make the duck the top story because, well, one of our listeners sent this in. Thank you, Vaughn. This poor duck. You know, there's a group out in California that rescues birds when there's an oil slick, an oil spill. And good for them because, you know what, that is, I can't even imagine.
That's a tough way to go.
To have that all over your feathers. But one of the ducks that they took in, a duck that did die, was rescued. It had some sort of internal problems. They x-rayed it and found this object inside that looks like an alien's head.
It looks like the typical alien gray.
When you look at the
x-ray, it looks as though it's somehow that this duck managed to swallow an infant alien.
It's just one of those odd artifacts, you know, sort of like seeing, you know, a face in your cornflakes.
Yeah, it is really bizarre. You'll have to see the picture at WatcherMagazine.com to see what we're talking about. But
apparently this has been removed. As I said, the duck did not survive, but they've removed it, and it's now on eBay. And they're doing this because they're trying to raise money for this organization that helps these animals.
Yeah, the International Bird Rescues Research Center, and they have got the X-ray up on eBay for sale. And as of the last time we checked, which as of about 6 p.m. Central Time on June 1st, was around $4,000 U.S., which is pretty amazing. But it's a striking photo, and it definitely makes for the top story on Watcher Magazine today.
Really amazing.
Well, here's a story that would really be a contender for top story, because this is this topic that we've been discussing for some months now. Carl Schwartz. In fact, we had the special interview with him just a couple of days ago about what he's doing with a group to try to provide some relief to veterans who've been exposed to depleted uranium in places like Bosnia and Kosovo and Iraq and Afghanistan. Finally, we're seeing a little bit of mainstream press exposure. The story that came from the UK about how they detected the radiation spike in the UK never made a dent over here in the United States press. But the Associated Press today, June 1st, is reporting on research done at Northern Arizona University that shows that uranium's heavy metal properties can make people sick independently of the radiation.
In other words, if you blow up a bomb, it disintegrates, it's and you inhale the dust.
Toxic, which is kind of a duh moment for those of you who've been listening. Of course, if you haven't been listening or you're not listening now, you can...
Well, if you're not listening now, then why are we even talking to you?
But the... I mean, it seems pretty obvious. It's a heavy metal. Lead is a heavy metal. Other heavy metals like mercury, cadmium, arsenic, those are all toxic. So it's not too surprising that uranium would be considered toxic. In fact, the Environmental Protection Agency and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission both consider depleted uranium, which is supposedly, you know, not radioactive.
It sounds like it's harmless.
Right.
It's depleted.
All it is just a real heavy metal. No big deal. Well, Northern Arizona University has published the first study, apparently, that indicates that it is toxic regardless of whether it is radioactive or not. What's interesting about this program at Northern Arizona University is that it's funded by the Native American Cancer Research Project, and that a number of Navajo researchers from Arizona are part of this team. The Navajos have had big parts of their, well, they've been uranium mining.
Oh, yeah.
On a big chunk of Navajo land, and the Navajo have then have had a long history of battles with cancer because they've been dealing with this stuff right there on their reservation. So maybe this will start to get people thinking that, you know, we need to quit using this stuff. Again, the NRC and the EPA consider it a hazardous material, but the Department of Defense continues to use this stuff for tank-busting shells, tank armor, and even sidearm ammunition.
No, they're still putting fluoride in our water. And it's listed as a poison. So what do you do?
So we'll see what happens with this story. But
if you know what our listeners can do, seriously, and that is, if you know anyone in the military or if you have family in the military, write to your Congress representative and say, look, pay attention to this story coming out of Arizona, because the fact is, Derek could only find references to this AP story being published in Arizona newspapers.
Yeah, as of about 7 o'clock Central Time here in the U.S., the only news sources reporting it were in Arizona, and that's probably because the research is being done at Northern Arizona University.
Right.
So we'd like to see this go national. Yeah, of course, the drums of war continue to beat with Iran. despite the fact that the United States is saying that we will talk with Iran, but only if they meet certain conditions. Ray McGovern, who's the former CIA analyst who had that little face-to-face confrontation at that news conference in Atlanta with Secretary Rumsfeld, in an interview today with Alex Jones, told him that he thinks it's going to be June or July, a strike on Iran. Now, it gets pretty hot over there at this time
of year.
That's
exactly what I was thinking. I thought, what a silly time to go over there. It's so hot.
Yeah. That is my thought on it. However, if you are thinking about going into Iran the way we went into Yugoslavia, the former Yugoslavia, with a long, drawn-out air campaign first and then a ground war, maybe you start that in June or July and then send troops in when things start to calm down 60 days later in September, October.
Well, I'm sitting here thinking about the Trident submarine story from a couple of days ago, thinking, okay, they can be even further away than that and not even have to fly over. Oh, no, no, that was not a nuclear missile we just lobbed at you.
Well, that's his opinion. We just mentioned that whether Mr. McGovern is correct in his analysis or not, he, again, is employing his experience as an analyst for the CIA to the problem. What's interesting, though, and this is a story that popped up a couple days ago, reported by Wayne Madsen, there, and this is a little bit not being reported in the mainstream media again, it's not known to most of the world, but to you, the PID ready.
PID listener.
Yes. In fact, there are negotiations and talks taking place between Iran and the United States. It's just not the government of the United States. It's the Iranian oil ministry and Halliburton that are discussing things.
Oh.
Yes. They're negotiating potential contracts to refurbish Iran's oil infrastructure. You see, they're making money on both sides of this deal. Halliburton goes in, they fix up the oil, we bomb it, needs fixing again. Halliburton goes back in, fixes it up again. It's a sweet deal.
Oh, imagine a Bush playing both sides. I just can't imagine.
It is interesting. Now, as somebody who doesn't work for Halliburton and a company that's not affiliated with it in any way, the company that I work for, we are not allowed to trade with Iran. I had a nice order earlier this year from a company based in Tehran, but it was their branch in Dubai, and we had to get them to sign off on a document stating...
You have to be very, very careful. You have to ask all sorts of questions and make them jump through hoops to prove who their end user really is.
Exactly. We had to demand that they sign a document stating that their final destination for the pipe, is that your final destination, was not one of the countries on our list. Syria, Iran, at the time Libya, but now they're okay. Sudan, North Korea. So, you know, they did, so we were able to... Depends. So we had to make them go through that and before we could sell them the material. But apparently when you're Halliburton, all that goes out the window and you don't have to play by those kind of rules.
Oh, boy. You know what? This is a little bit of a left turn, but I want to mention this. There's an op-ed piece that I put in here today from the New York Daily News, and I put it in here because I think this guy speaks for many New Yorkers. Michael Chertoff, the wonderful head of the Homeland Security administration, has come out and announced who gets what kind of money. And they are cutting funding to New York.
Anti-terrorist?
Yes. This
government
is their terrorism
anti-terrorist
money.
Assistant.
They, and the reason they're cutting funding to New York is because New York doesn't have any landmarks.
What? New York.
This says, by Chertoff's reckoning, New York has not a single national monument or icon that needs special security. Now, let me say this.
Statue of Liberty?
St. Louis was given more money this year.
Because we've got the arch.
Was increased by about 23% or something like that.
Yeah. And New York's funding, according to this article, was cut by 40%.
Yes.
Now, that is really... That's really weird. I know that we've got what's called the Jefferson Memorial, which you know as the Arch. And that is, believe it or not, the most visited monument, national monument in the United States.
And smack dab in the middle of the United States.
I mean, that was a surprise to me to find that out. But it is a lot easier to get to, to you know, get in and get out of than most places in Washington. And a lot safer, too, I must say.
A lot less expensive, too.
And a lot less expensive. And it is a really cool, really is really cool. But still, I mean... New York, you would think, would be if not the number one target in the United States, it would be in the top five.
Yeah.
Sure. I mean, we still got the Empire State Building there, the Statue of Liberty, of course.
Yes.
There are plenty of landmarks in New York, and this just doesn't make a whole lot of sense. However, and in fact, I posted about this on my blog over lunch today because this did catch my eye when you posted this to Watcher Magazine. This is not inconsistent with Mr. Chertoff's past behavior. Again, another story that is not well known but has been thoroughly documented by researcher Indira Singh. And Jeff Wells blogged about it at his blog, Rigorous Intuition, and tied all the threads together in a neat little package. Basically, what it boils down to is that when Michael Chertoff was the head of the criminal division for the Department of Justice, he squashed an investigation into terrorist financing connected to a company, a software company called PTEC. PTEC, based in Boston, was financed basically, almost exclusively by a guy whose name I won't be able to pronounce, but was designated by an executive order from the president as a terrorist.
Mm-hmm.
So the FBI had an investigation into terror funding, or rather the Department of Homeland Security had this investigation. They held Operation Green Quest. They were trying to shut down the money supply for terrorists. Chertoff and the Department of Justice basically took over the investigation, took it away from Homeland Security, rolled it into the FBI's jurisdiction, and even though this guy, Yassin El-Khadi, was the backer for this company, PTEC, which, by the way, held software contracts worth millions of dollars with the FAA, the Air Force, and the FBI, by the way.
Yes.
They quashed the investigation, and nobody was ever investigated or prosecuted.
Well, PTEC's right in the middle of that whole web, the
Wall of Paranoia. Right.
If you look at that photo, and we'll link to it again in the show notes.
That's right.
You'll see it on there.
So anyway, this isn't too terribly surprising, and New Yorkers, we understand why you would feel a little miffed by this. But
speaking of surprise, what a shock when George Bush found out about Haditha.
he doesn't read the papers or watch the news. He said so.
No, he's busy.
Yeah, so he's announced that the details of the investigation, when it's complete, will be made public.
And I saw on Fox News today that people who are now in over there in the military and those going over there in the military will have to undergo some social sensitivity training.
Sensitivity training.
Sort of like the ones that had to go down through the training before they went down to New Orleans to help with Katrina cleanup.
Oh, yeah.
You remember that silly story?
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry, but I think this gets back to what you said the other day. How dare any government put young men and women in the position of having to make decisions about firing on civilians?
Mm-hmm.
I know that the Marines, that all of the military people that are in country there are under a lot of stress.
Mm-hmm.
Just as in Vietnam, you couldn't tell all the time, many times, who was a friendly.
Mm-hmm. And if we go into Iran, it is going to be just as bad. Because, in fact, there was a story, I can't remember if it was today or yesterday, where they have announced that the game plan over there is going to be guerrilla warfare.
Just like Iraq. In fact, they're war gaming it right now.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and that was in Watcher today.
This is a mountainous region.
Yes, a much bigger territory than Iraq, and of course they've got a lot more people there too, and many other urban areas which are extremely dangerous.
Yeah.
So yeah, this would only be worse if we were to send ground troops into Iran. So yeah, this Haditha story is ugly, and
I can't believe he didn't know about that. I think. Yes, he did.
Yeah, well, absolutely. I mean,
started earlier this year. I mean, it was in February or early March that the investigation started. Rumsfeld had to have told him about it.
And the incident took place in November, so it's you know that the government had to know at some level.
Oh, yeah. You don't blindside your president at a press conference with a question about something he knows nothing about.
No.
I think we have time for one more story, Henry.
All right.
You wanna jump in on that?
Well, a couple of things. Let's pick one out of the hat here. I kind of thought that it was one of the fallout from the Da Vinci Code, Well, let's go this direction here.
Oh, over Tom's hair?
Well, besides the reaction to Tom Hanks' hair.
His hair is goofy.
Yeah, it was not a good look. I mean, I know in the book the guy has, you know, long college professor's hair, but on Tom Hanks it just was not a good look. Yeah. No, the priest of Rosslyn Chapel, which was a site that figured prominently in the novel, mm-hmm. has resigned. Because, and speculation is that is because he's just tired of dealing with the attention from all of these people who want to make a trek there to see if they can figure out the codes and find the grail there at Rosslyn Chapel. So Reverend Michael Fass, who had who's been very public in the past about the sensational speculation about the connection between the Holy Grail and Rosslyn Chapel in Scotland, is going to leave his post next month, July.
Wow.
And he's just said that, according to friends, that the fuss caused by the book and now the movie has just made his position unbearable. They've only got a congregation of 300 people there in this little village, Rosslyn. Mm-hmm. But because of the book and now the movie, they've got thousands and thousands of people who are making a pilgrimage to Rosslyn Chapel to try to figure out the codes and the architecture.
Soon they'll have healings there.
And the Virgin Mary will appear.
Yes, and also statuettes.
Hey, you know, it worked for Glastonbury and King Arthur's tomb,
exactly.
You know.
Exactly.
And we start selling, you know, the little knickknacks and stuff, and that'll pay for the new roof.
Yeah.
Well, we've got a great interview in progress as Prophecy Series continues. Peter Goodgame has done an awful lot of research into the history of the ancient Near East and how that history connects to the accounts that were given to us in the books of Genesis and the early books of the Bible. And he also connects it back to what is ahead, what's coming as far as prophecy. So let's go now to part two of our interview with author Peter Goodgame.
Yesterday we covered the background of the biblical Nimrod and gave you a little historical context on what Nimrod did that God considered so offensive. Also tied him into history as the Sumerian king Enmerkar, identified from the Sumerian king list. Obviously this is a giant of history. He has been remembered through the ages, and not just in the Bible, but in a lot of different ways. Peter Goodgame, what was Nimrod's legacy? As a politician, you know, we know that that's something Bill Clinton was worried about. George W. Bush's legacy is in the process of being written. What was Nimrod's legacy in the years after he shuffled off this mortal coil?
Yes, well, we have to understand this from the perspective that after Nimrod was killed and his empire was destroyed, what happened was the division of the nations event, okay?
Mm-hmm.
This is when God stepped back from the scene and allowed the fallen angels to take personal control and authority over the nations of the world, and he allowed them to basically to run affairs as they saw fit. And I think this is the origin of paganism as a religious system that most importantly involves metaphysical methods all revolving around shamanism, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Getting in touch with the spirit world, getting in touch with non-human entities, and taking directions from there.
Okay.
So I think this is how paganism began.
Okay.
And so Nimrod's memory was, in the hands of the fallen angels, Nimrod's memory became a very positive memory, okay? And Nimrod was deified very shortly thereafter. He was deified. He became worshipped as a god. Now, this was a step-by-step process of building him up, but where at the beginning, we have Nimrod becoming viewed as a hero, okay, then as semi-divine, and then finally as fully divine, and then finally as the head of the pagan pantheon. And to begin with, let's step back and look at another important idea that I put forward in my Giza Discovery series.
Well, just for context, Nimrod wasn't remembered as under that name as a god, was he? I mean, or did he have different names?
He was remembered by a number of different names, because at the division of nations, he also had the creation of the many different languages.
Many different languages, right? Okay.
Absolutely. So it's like every different culture had their own memory of Nimrod, and they knew him by a different name.
Mm-hmm.
It's what can be expected. But you know, I'm very familiar with the work of Alexander Hislop, The Two Babylons.
Right.
And it's funny. I don't really give his work a lot of credit. I don't. But what because I was brought into contact with a big critic of his work, who's this guy, Ralph Woodrow, and he wrote this book called The Babylon Connection, mm-hmm. with a question mark. He really tears Hislop apart and shows that a lot of his scholarship was very shoddy, full of speculation, yeah. and not very good at all. But what Hislop did is everywhere he looked in pagan mythology, he saw Nimrod.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm being brought around to the view that essentially he was correct, at least that far. Nimrod appeared everywhere.
Okay, so what are some of the names by which he was remembered?
To begin with, there's a little city-state out close to Eridu. He became known as the god Asar-Luhi. The name Asar connects with Osiris,
okay.
the Babylonian pantheon. And then I'm not going to get too much into Egypt today, but we covered this in the previous interview. I think it was in January, but yeah,
right.
the ancient Egyptian god Osiris was Nimrod. It was a deification of Nimrod.
Okay. Now, we'll put a link back to that old interview for people who want to catch all of those connections.
Yeah. But in the Mesopotamian area, he became known as Asar-Luhi, Ningirsu, Ninurta, and in the city of Kish, which is a very important center of a dynasty, he was known as Zababa. Okay, the links are there, and the Sumerians understood them to be the same as well.
Okay.
They were just different names for the same figure. And eventually, the figure, the deified Nimrod emerged as the god Marduk by the time of the rise of Babylon, of the Babylonian Empire under Hammurabi.
Okay. So the fallen, or the 70, B'nai Elohim, sons of God, who were placed over the 70 nations that were divided up after the Tower of Babel, took the memory of Nimrod and then sort of elevated his memory as a...
Yes, they used the memory of Nimrod to displace any memory of the Creator, whether he was understood as Enlil or Anu or whatever. But yeah, Marduk pushes them to the side. And it's kind of a step-by-step process, and it can be viewed through all of the myths and legends of the god Ninurta.
Okay.
Ninurta was a very huge figure in Sumerian mythology. He, according to the myths, one of these myths, Ninurta received his wisdom and his knowledge that it gave him the hidden key to all this power. He picked this up after his journey to Eridu and a meeting with Enki.
Ah.
Yes, that was where Ninurta got his power from. But now another very important point to make, though, is that in the myths, Ninurta, at the beginning, Ninurta is referred to as the son of Enlil, okay, which might throw people off. But let's look at this from the perspective that the Sumer, was really the center where Yahweh, Jehovah, the worship of Jehovah was located.
Mm-hmm.
This goes back to what a lot of the Sumerian scholars think, that the name Sumer itself refers to as derived from Shem, the son of Noah.
It was
Shem's line through which Israel was born. So mm-hmm. after the division of the nations, this area had a very distinct memory of the Creator. So, and I really think that when Nimrod, took part in his conquests and did everything that he did, he said that he was doing it in the name of God. Okay.
Okay. All right.
I think he made that claim. So, if there's an agenda to elevate this king and to deify him, they need to say that he's the son of God. So that's essentially what they did. They referred to him as the son of Enlil. But what we find in the text and in all his exploits, Enlil was really portrayed as kind of helpless and stupid, okay?
Okay.
And Ninurta comes on the scene and has to save his butt time after time after time. And then there's another myth talking about the return of Ninurta to Nippur, this myth. And it begins by a statement such as, you have taken up the divine powers of Eridu, which are huge as the earth. Okay, mm-hmm. and then it mentions... he's coming to... Okay, it's important to understand what Nippur was, first of all.
Mm-hmm.
Nippur was the holy city of Enlil.
Okay.
It was also the city where, of all the ancient Sumerian texts that we have recovered, mm-hmm. that in the present day, 80% of them have come from Nippur.
Really?
Yes. That was really the center of learning in ancient Sumeria. So
now Nippur was also known as Nibiru, was it not?
That is correct. Beth is absolutely right. Nibiru is Nippur. Okay, it's not a 12th planet out there.
Okay.
Absolutely not. Sitchin is way off base as usual.
Okay.
So most of
what we know about this, about ancient Sumer, comes from Nippur.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Well, and I also think this calls into question the claim that that Enmerkar created was the first person to begin writing. I think it was the city of Enlil. I think human beings got to this skill from God, initially. Mm-hmm. And I think Enmerkar took credit for it.
Now, and I don't mean to sidetrack things here, but just something that I'm curious about. Now, Sumer derives from the name Shem.
Yes, Samuel Noah Kramer believes that is the case, and he's like the most well-respected Sumerologist.
Okay, now Nimrod or Enmerkar was a descendant of Ham, Shem's brother, not from Shem.
Yes. Nimrod was a descendant of Ham through Cush.
Okay, so Cush being in Ethiopia. Can we assume that Nimrod went back as a conqueror and conquered the descendants of Shem?
That's kind of the area that I'm looking at. I think we can find, and that's the Osiris legend says that, you know, the beginning of his empire was Egypt.
Okay.
And after he had subdued Egypt, then he subdued the entire world, even as far as India, according to the Egyptians.
Okay. Now, I didn't want to get us too far off track there.
Oh, no.
But, just something that my historic interest got piqued there. Okay,
yeah.
So back to Ninurta, the son of Enlil, who had to go back to Nippur because Enlil wasn't capable of handling things on his own.
Yes, Enlil was incapable. He had to save him on a number of occasions from these monsters. And what we find, one of the most important things that Ninurta did is he defeated a seven-headed dragon. Okay.
A seven-headed dragon.
Seven-headed dragon.
Okay, so we're at the 30-minute mark, and we finally get to something with the prophetic implications here. But I just say that tongue-in-cheek, because I know we had to lay a lot of groundwork to get where we're going. Anyone who's read anything about the Book of Revelation should recognize the seven-headed dragon. What was the story about Ninurta and the seven-headed dragon?
Unfortunately, there's not a lot. But let's look at, on my website, when this interview airs, I'm going to have a link to a very important article on Biblical Archaeology Review from that magazine.
Okay.
There's this artifact that dates to about 2600 BC, and scholars believe that it is a depiction of Ninurta battling a seven-headed dragon. And I think it does connect with the Book of Revelation. I'm trying to explain why. Now, that's the first artifact that it references a seven-headed dragon.
Mm-hmm.
The first literary reference to a seven-headed dragon comes in from these artifacts referred to as the Gudea Cylinders, and it's a story of the building of Ningirsu's temple in the city of Lagash by this king known as Gudea, okay? And what we find, it's very interesting, this king goes into has a dream. The gods reach out to him, and he is essentially told that his job is to build a great temple to this god. And Ningirsu is Ninurta. It's the same god.
Mm-hmm.
Same god. But one of the things that he does after he makes this temple is he brings all the trophies that the god Ningirsu has accumulated all over his career. And one of these trophies is a seven-headed serpent or a seven-headed dragon.
Really?
The reference in this Gudea cylinder that dates back to like 2100, 2200 BC, it just talks about after this temple was built, he says, the text says, facing the city, its place laden with awe, he had the seven-headed serpent take its stand. And then it says, because these were warriors slain by Ningirsu, he set their mouths towards libation places. But in this myth here of the building of Ningirsu's temple, it goes over Ningirsu's career, and Ngirsu, like Ninurta, is the son of Enlil. But his mentor, his personal mentor, kind of like an uncle or something, is the god Enki. And Ningirsu comes from Eridu. That's where he came from. And then, now going back to the return of Ninurta to Nippur, when Ninurta comes to Enlil's holy city, we find statements such as, well, when he comes, Enlil's overcome by the glory and the brightness of Ninurta's appearance. And so he sends out sends out one of his servants to tell Ninurta, please, Ninurta, take it easy. You're scaring your father. That kind of thing.
Interesting. Interesting. One of the things, and again, don't mean to dive off into a rabbit trail here, down a rabbit trail, but one of the things that I discovered recently, or learned, I shouldn't say I discovered anything, one of the things I learned that surprised me was the symbol for the 32nd degree Scottish Rite Freemason is a double-headed eagle, which is known as the Eagle of Lagash.
The Eagle of Lagash, yes.
And Lagash, as you mentioned, was the city that was protected by Ningirsu, and this double-headed eagle was the symbol of the god Ningirsu, or Nimrod, which again is how we tie Freemasonry back to this this whole, I don't know if you want to call veneration, but honor of Nimrod.
It all goes back to Sumer. It all goes back to Nimrod, and then it even all goes back to this god Enki. And then there's just a statement near the end of this Ninurta's return to Nippur. It says, Ninurta's, you know, talking about himself again. He says, I am the strong one, unopposed in the mountains. I am Ninurta. Let them prostrate themselves at my knee. I am the exceedingly mighty lion-headed one of Enlil, whom he engendered in his strength, the storm of heaven, shackle of the gods. I am the one whom Anu in his great might has chosen. And then he says, I am the creature of Inanna. I am the warrior destined with Enki to be suited for the fearsome divine powers. Let my kingship be manifest unto the ends of heaven and earth. I am most able among the gods. Let me be imbued with great awesomeness. So this is, Ninurta, or the cult that revolved around worship of this god, they had a definite agenda to displace Enlil at the top of the pantheon and install Ninurta.
So what do you make of this story? I mean, obviously, we can see the symbol, the similarity in the symbols of the seven-headed dragon, the seven-headed snake, with the beast described in Revelation chapter 12. But what do you make of this?
What I really think is, now this gets into the book of Revelation and my understanding of the seven-headed dragon in Revelation. I think in Revelation chapter 17, we're explained very simply what the seven heads represent. And it simply says that the seven heads are seven kings. Okay, I don't take it farther. I don't think it's kingdoms. Mm-hmm. I don't insert an interpretation in the text that's not there. Now, in the book of Daniel, when it's describing the four beasts of Daniel, it refers to them as kings and as kingdoms, which is why scholars, they really take the kingdom view for the beasts. But that there's not that further amplification of what the heads of the dragon represent in Revelation. It simply says they're kings, so I think they're individuals. I do not think we're looking at the usual interpretation is that they refer to, from the beginning, Egypt, Assyria, Greece, Persia, and the Roman Empire, and then finally some end times empire. I don't agree with that view. I think they are individuals. And just to go over briefly my interpretation of who could these individuals be, Revelation says that of these seven heads, of these seven kings, five at the time of the writing of Revelation, five had already come and gone. Five have been already.
Mm-hmm.
One presently existed. One was in the future. And then the eighth would be one of the seven. One who once was, now is not, yet shall be.
Mm-hmm.
So going down the list of the seven, the five that preceded the writing of Revelation, I think Nimrod was the one that began it. I think Nimrod was that was the beginning of pagan religion.
Mm-hmm.
That was the beginning of angelic authority over the nations of the world. I think Nimrod was the first. I think that Pharaoh at the time of the Exodus was the second. Then it was, I think it was, it's referred to in Ezekiel chapter 28, I believe, the king of Tyre.
Oh, right.
Is another one. And also the next one after that is the king of Babylon. And both of these descriptions of the king of Tyre and the king of Babylon, we find a seamless transition between characteristics given of a human being that transition into description of Satan.
Mm-hmm.
We learn more about Satan in these two passages than almost, you know, the rest of the Bible.
Right. It was Ezekiel 28, and then the king of Babylon is referred to in what, Isaiah 14?
Isaiah 14.
Right, okay.
Yes. So I think that the reason they transition seamlessly is because these kings were possessed by Satan. They were one of the seven heads. And I think this, I got to research this further, but I think it was a king known as Ithobel in Tyre, who was the father of Jezebel.
Oh, okay.
Yes, I think that's how it ties in.
Hmm.
So, Nimrod, Pharaoh of Egypt at the time of the Exodus, the king of Tyre, the king of Babylon, who was Sennacherib, and the fifth was Antiochus Epiphanes.
Okay.
He was another, you know, person who blasphemed God and who persecuted God's people. The sixth, I think, would have to be someone who was alive at the time of the writing of the book of Revelation. I think it was either Nero or perhaps Domitian. I really think there's a lot of evidence for an early writing of Revelation. Although I'm not a preterist, I think that Nero Caesar, probably best fits the descriptions, and he's well known for his persecution of Christians.
Sure.
So that's the first six. And then it said there would be one to come in the future.
Okay.
I think that was Hitler. And I also think that Hitler is who is portrayed at the opening of the first seal of Revelation.
Mm-hmm.
This ties in with my Red Moon rapture chronology of the end times. I think the first five seals are the birth pangs of the apocalypse. I don't think the rapture happens until the sixth seal, and I don't think the 7 years starts until after that.
Mm-hmm.
So this is something that people can look up on in my book, Shameless Plug, Red Moon Rising, available mm-hmm. at Amazon.com.
And highly recommended by the Bunker crew.
Thank you. But getting back to that, I think that completes the list. Hitler was the final one. He was the one that was expected in the future at the time of the writing of Revelation. Now, the Antichrist,
and then there's
once was, now is not, and yet shall be. He will come up out of the abyss, and then he'll be alive for the last 7 years, and he'll have all power for the last 3.5 years. We have to look at one of the first five, resurrecting again.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're going to see the return of Nimrod, whether he's known as Osiris or Marduk or who knows. But I go into this in my Giza conspiracy. That's the whole idea behind that whole series.
What?
So that's how I think the seven-headed dragon needs to be understood. And I think at the time of the division of nations, getting back to ancient Sumer, I think that before God did this, he let it be known to his people that what he was decreeing. And I think the ancient Sumer had an idea that they should fear a seven-headed dragon, that they had this symbolism of an evil beast that was an enemy of God and an enemy of humanity. And I think that the pagan priests kind of inverted the story a little bit. They raised up Ninurta, who was a deification of Nimrod, who I think was the first head of the beast. And they gave him the role as the conqueror of this seven-headed dragon.
Well, let's hold right there. I want to tease ahead a little bit and save some material for our third segment. When we've got plenty to cover, of course, but let's discuss why the pagan priests would do that sort of thing and what purpose that would serve as a sort of a twisting of prophecy. We're discussing the end times with Peter Goodgame and showing the connections between the history of the ancient Mesopotamians, ancient Sumer, and the ancient Hebrews, and how it's significant for the prophecy of Daniel, Ezekiel, John, and the years that are still ahead for us. Peter Goodgame, our guest, and we'll continue our discussion with him tomorrow on PID Radio.
Now, you can log on to Peter Goodgame's website anytime you want to, redmoonrising.com, and you can read some of his articles, the Giza series that he's written.
Mm-hmm.
That will be coming out as a book, but you can have a free peek at it if mm-hmm. you go to redmoonrising.com. And you can listen to part 3 of our interview with Peter tomorrow on PID Radio.
The number of the interviews is 3.
5. Oh, 3, sir.
5 is right out. Well, next week we've got David W. Lowe, author of Earthquake Resurrection, and we're going to talk about some of the basics of the timeline of the events in progress, and we'll give you a little hint. He and Peter Goodgame are in agreement and that the four horsemen of the apocalypse are already loose and riding around the planet.
I've seen them.
Usually on my way to work in the morning, they're the guys in the left lane going too fast. And so we've got that coming up, and we've got a special interview that we will bring out over the weekend. We'll tell you about that yet.
We can't tell you about that. A secret, but it is coming up on Saturday, so you don't want to miss that.
And there's some very interesting new information there, which again relates to the situation in the Middle East.
Well, I think that wraps things up for today. Send us a note if you want to. You can write to us at radio@peeringintodarkness.com.
And the forum is always open, even the middle of the night. We got the coffee on there. It's peeringintodarkness.com/forum.
Oh, if we only had a drive-up window at the forum. I'll take 4 dozen Krispy Kreme specials and some coffee.
Brilliant.
I know. We can only do that virtual drive-up window. We'll work on that.
Mm-hmm.
In the meanwhile, we'll have to settle for, salads or something. Until then, I'm Sharon Gilbert.
I'm Derek Gilbert. Thanks for listening to PID Radio.
Bye-bye. Cookies. We can have cookies.
Gonna step up to the microphone. Say it loud.